Is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa and sometimes beyond, as you will find with our next guest. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen. During the first half of the program, we discussed climate change and some of the things that Ames will be doing to address it, including making use of the sun's energy for electricity. Our next guest comes from his annual winter trip to a sunnier region, but he doesn't go there for the weather. Welcome to Dan Bean, who lives on a farm east of Marshalltown, but brings us stories from a refugee camp in Zimbabwe. Thanks for coming to Ames this morning to bring us a vision of a different world.
Thank you, Susan. I'm really happy to be here.
Good. Thanks. And so how did you first travel to Africa?
I first went to Africa, I think it was 55 years ago. I was teaching school in Kenya. I was 3 years teaching vocational agriculture in a high school there.
Was this part of the Peace Corps or something else?
No, I was registered with the draft board as a conscientious objector, so I was fulfilling my obligations for alternative service.
And why was teaching agriculture in Africa alternative service?
Well, alternative service has to be something that's done for the good of the country. And I think they felt that building relationships with other nations was something positive for the United States.
And so this did this predate the Peace Corps? I'm trying to remember from that.
About the same time, I think Peace Corps had gotten started 3 or 4 years before I went. But I was not really affiliated with Peace Corps. I was with Columbia University had a program that I was working with.
Well, so that's a long, long time ago. You haven't been going back regularly since then, have you?
I've been back probably 20 or 25 times to Kenya. I've been going quite often, yes.
Oh, well, always to Kenya or?
Most of my work has been in Kenya. I've worked in Tanzania and most recently down in Zimbabwe as well, yes.
So, well, now I believe your son had something to do with your current
Yes. My son is a principal of a Christian school in Nova Scotia, and one of his goals is that every student will have the opportunity to do a service project in a developing country. So he was interested in getting his students into the refugee camps in Africa, and he asked me to go and investigate a couple refugee camps, the Kakuma camp in northwest Kenya and the Tongagora camp down in Zimbabwe. And I always said, I'm happy for an excuse to go to Africa.
So well, it doesn't sound to me like refugee camps would be particularly enjoyable places to visit.
It doesn't sound like it. I'll confess I do enjoy going to the refugee camps because I like relating to the people. I like hearing their stories. I like trying to understand why they fled from their countries of origin and what their life is like in the camp and what they see in their future.
Well, you mentioned the religious – that your son was teaching in a Christian school. I heard you say in our conversation something about the Mennonites. Now, Mennonites are a historic peace church like the Quakers. Isn't that right?
Right, yes. My son had served for 7 years down in Bolivia with the Mennonite Central Committee is sort of how we've made a connection with the Mennonites, yes.
Oh, so not – that wasn't when you had your alternative service.
No.
It wasn't as a Mennonite.
No. Actually, I'm a Quaker.
Okay. But it was interesting to me when you told me about the refugee camp. Who administers the refugee camps?
there are sort of two levels of administration in the refugee camps. In Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe government has a representative there who actually administers the camp. But the funding comes from the United Nations through the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And the thing that surprised me was that there really are no United Nations employees in the refugee camps, but the work is all done by various NGOs. For example, there's a group called Terra di Home Italia, an Italian organization that does the primary schools and the preschool and the health clinics. The Jesuit Refugee Services furnishes the secondary education. There's an organization called GOAL that furnishes the water and the various programs to generate income for the refugees, such as some crop production and livestock production. So the actual work in the camp then is done by these different NGOs, and the funding then comes through the United Nations.
Well, I guess what interested me was your story about your hosts seemed to be Jesuits, and I thought that was interesting because you don't hear so much about the Jesuits anymore, and certainly not in context of working with other groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a small group working for the Jesuit Refugee Service in Tongagora, but Jesuit Refugee Services are involved in many different refugee camps around the world and have a fairly large presence in these camps. Personally, I'd never been associated with them before either, but it was the group that my son had made initial contact with, and they were delightful hosts while I was in the camp.
Now, you said what you enjoyed was hearing the people's stories, talking to the people. It sounds like these camps are not just temporary until people get resettled someplace else.
I always had the vision that people were in the camps for a matter of weeks or months or maybe a year until things settled down and they went back home again. I've talked to a lot of people in the Tongagora camp who've been there 15 and 20 years, and it sounds like they might be there forever. In Tongagora camp in Zimbabwe, the majority of the people come from the DRC, which is the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC is the largest country in Africa and quite rich in minerals, copper and gold and diamonds and other important metals for us. And a lot of conflicts have arisen in the DRC over control of these resources. It's sort of been continual civil war there since independence in 1960. And so a lot of people are displaced by these wars that go on. The people that are in the camp have seen a lot of atrocities in their lifetime back in the DRC. Every one of them told me, I'm never going back there again. So they're either trying to get resettled in some other country or maybe integrated into the Zimbabwe economy.
And can the Zimbabwe economy handle these people?
Zimbabwe right now is a basket case economically. I'm told that there's something over 80% unemployment just among the Zimbabwe population, which makes it sort of problematic for refugees to be integrated into the economy. At the same time, some of the refugees are leaving the camp, going to the capital city and trying to survive there, running small shops or some way just to eke out a living.
Now, you said you had some stories. So what is it? What are some of these refugee stories?
There's been two or three interesting ones I can relate to you. I met a man named Rashidi who came from the DRC. He was a doctor, an anesthesiologist, and he'd worked for several years in the DRC. He'd worked for Doctors Without Borders, and he'd worked in private clinics. In the last clinic he was working in, which was not too far from the Rwanda border, and incidentally, most of the problems in the DRC seem to occur in the eastern part of the country, not too far from Rwanda. So he was working in this clinic, and one of the rebel groups overran the town he was in. They came to the clinic and told the doctors they were going to work for them now. The doctors sort of said, well, they didn't really want to do that, so they just promptly shot half of them dead. Rashidi was locked into a small room in the clinic while they went away and the rebels went away and did some other things. He knocked a hole in the ceiling and escaped and ran to his house and collected his documents and some money and his family, and they ran. They went about 20 miles down the road to another town and tried to stop there. The people found out they'd come from this town that had been overrun by the rebels. They accused them of being part of the rebel group and threatened them again. He kept running and eventually ended up in the refugee camp in Tongogara. Rashidi is an interesting case. The refugee camp is quite hot. And after 3 or 4 years in the refugee camp, his wife and his family went to the capital city about 8 hours away, where they rented a small room and they put the children in school there. His wife sells a few things on the side of the road to make a little income. Rashidi stayed in the camp because he had responsibilities with the church, and he also was supporting some orphans who were either relatives or friends. He has made progress on resettlement in the United States. There's a portion of the State Department called the Refugee Resettlement Organization that handles that, and he's made the first two steps. He has a case number now. I suspect he and his family might be in the States within a couple of years. So it's been a rough time for him.
But obviously he has a very high level of skill. What are some of the other stories?
I knew a woman named Emanuela who came out of the DRC. There's a lot of lawlessness in the country because the government just isn't able to function with these constant wars. And in that lawlessness, you get a lot of bandits preying on people. So about 10 years ago, her husband was killed by a group of bandits. And somewhere in that intervening time, she was befriended by a man from Belgium who was working in the country, a white man. And he was paying the school fees for her children. So the people assumed that when a white man is involved that there's money there. And the people said, well, this friend of yours is giving you a lot of money. We want some of that money. So they attacked her in the night and cut her up badly with machetes and left her for dead on the road. She got to the hospital and recovered and immediately fled to the refugee camp. She was in the refugee camp a while, and after a couple of years, she made her way to Rwanda, where some of her children were, and I'm hoping that she'll be able to remain there. But it's for a single woman in the refugee camps, it can be quite daunting as well.
You mentioned that they had plots where they could grow things. Mm-hmm. So are some of the women farmers?
They tried to make the refugees as self-sufficient as they can. So there's a 200-acre irrigated field adjacent to the camp that they've divided up into plots of land for 800 different families. They grow three crops a year there. The United Nations furnishes the seed and the fertilizer and any chemicals they need for those crops. And people can either eat the crops or they can sell them. One of the organizations works with them on a little bit of livestock production as well. I should mention that up until this year, the United Nations had a food distribution once a month in the camp when people would line up and be distributed food based on the number of family members they had. About 6 months ago, they changed that program to where they're now distributing money to the refugees and allowing them to buy food in the camp or within the community. I think it's an effort to sort of sustain the local economy as well. So they're given $13 per month for each member of the family. $13 doesn't sound like very much to live on for a month, so I think it's pretty tight for the families, but somehow they manage.
Well, that's very interesting. So what do you do when you go there?
When I go to the camp, I visit the schools. I walk around the streets. I meet different people. I try to go to their homes and visit with them about where they came from, why they fled, how long they've been here, what their hopes are for the future. Just trying to relate to them and be a presence, say, you know, I care about your condition. I'm here to listen to your story.
But no practical aid, just...
I'm not there to bring anything in the way of material goods or money to them. Both the staff and the staff members and the refugees feel quite isolated in these camps, like maybe the world has forgotten that they're there. So both of those groups of people, the staff members and the refugees, have said to me, you know, we just appreciate your coming and listening to our stories.
Do you have any concluding remarks?
I think some people are not aware of how many refugee camps there are in the world. There's about 200 refugee camps recognized by the United Nations in 128 different countries. The largest refugee camp is in Bangladesh now for the Rohingya refugees from Myanmar, about 900,000 people in that camp. The second largest camp is the Bidi Bidi camp in Uganda with about 300,000 people from the South Sudan. Dadaab camp is the third largest with about 290,000 people from Somalia and Sudan and different places. Kakuma with almost 200,000. These are large numbers of refugees in the world. And so it's a big issue that we're glad that there's a United Nations there to help support these people.
These sound like they'd be pretty good-sized cities. Do they have they're just organized by the NGOs?
The host country sort of designates where the camp is going to be and what its size is going to be. And then the United Nations furnishes the funds and sort of sets out the rules. And then these different NGOs administer the programs, the water distribution, the food, the education, the health care, and special programs for, say, vulnerable women and children, special programs for people with special health needs, and try to meet the refugees' needs in those ways.
Well, that is a very interesting way to see the world through the eyes of an Iowa farmer.
It does seem a bit out of character for a farmer, doesn't it?
Well, thank you very much.
We've just been talking with Dan Bean, who farms near Marshalltown, and has been telling us about his experiences in Africa.